Hi, everybody. Hello. Welcome to the Coffee Break. I'm Daniel. I'm here as usual with my friend Tom. What's up, Tom?
Hey, guys. How's it going?
How are you? How's everything going?
Excellent.
How was your past few weeks? Anything interesting?
Pretty good. Anything interesting? Lots of interesting things in my personal life, but nothing so relevant that I can start explaining about dentistry to everyone, you know? So,
yeah.
Not so relevant.
Dentistry is not interesting.
I did a fascinating root canal.
It's important for your well-being, but it's not interesting.
Exactly.
Did you go to the Pride Parade this weekend?
No, I did not go. Because we hate gays. We established that. No, I didn't go. I wanted to actually go to the one in Jerusalem. I find it a bit more meaningful. Like, it's a bit more of a march.
Yeah.
Like, for equal rights, rather than in Tel Aviv, which is just a huge party.
Yeah, because Jerusalem is more problematic toward the people in Jerusalem tend to be less
open.
Yes. Less liberal.
Yeah,
towards gay people.
Yeah,
so it's more of a protest, like there, and less of a party.
Yeah, less of a party. Even though Jerusalem has some cool parties, has some cool street parties, just not specifically for gays.
But I
couldn't go in the end, and then in Tel Aviv, I don't think I've ever been. I'm like one of the only people
I've
in
never
Tel Aviv
been.
That, yeah,
I've oh, never been
nice,
because
man.
I tend to avoid those kinds of events.
That are crowded?
That has gay people in them.
Oh, okay.
No. They are crowded. It's too crowded for me.
There's someone like sitting somewhere in Canada being like super triggered.
Hey,
like, oh
fuck
my god.
Hey.
Man, I can't believe that they just said that. Like, you can't talk about gays that way.
Well, now you pissed off gays and Canadians.
And Canadians, yeah. You know that I have a friend of mine. He went to Canada for a student exchange. Mm-hmm. And I forgot exactly what he studies, and I forgot what the course was. And then they showed the part of a movie, I think, and there was like a really annoying kid there. And he said, like, jokingly, you know, oh my god, someone needs to slap this kid. And this girl behind him, like this, you know, social justice warrior girl behind him, came up like, just so you know, like, we don't slap kids in this country. I don't know where you're from in the world, but it's like, wow. That is so, like, he's like, he said, I didn't even want to explain to her that I was joking. I was like, oh, okay, thank you for letting me know.
What countries do you slap kids in? Is it like a national thing somewhere?
I don't think it's a national thing. I just think it's like, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I think in a lot of places around the world, you can find kids being slapped.
I think you can find kids being slapped everywhere.
Yeah, you
even
think?
In Canada.
Even in Canada?
Even in Canada.
Maybe like on a remote farm somewhere.
All right. I tend to avoid those kind of events.
Yeah.
Too much people, midsummer, noon.
Too much of the commoners.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's too much of the
sweaty commoners.
I prefer to stay home with my air conditioning and play computer games.
Ah, you nerd.
Yeah.
Alright. Anyway, I think last episode we did, it was like right after the elections.
Yes, yeah.
And now, surprise, surprise.
Yeah, we go again.
Yeah, new elections
go
in Israel.
Again, round two.
Yeah.
Yeah, so how it works basically is when your party wins the most votes during the elections, you get the right to the president, which is a formal
job
position.
Yeah, it's a formal
Israel.
Position.
It gives you the right to form a coalition, and you can either succeed or fail.
Yeah,
and Bibi failed because he couldn't get enough parties to join him.
Yeah.
Right, to form a coalition that's more than 50% of the Knesset, of
right.
the parliament.
Right,
and yeah, we go again.
Yeah. I kind of knew he wouldn't do it. But so usually what happens is that either you, if you won the elections, either you would go and you failed to establish a coalition. So you go to the president of Israel and you tell him, like, listen, I couldn't form a coalition.
Listen, man.
Give it to someone else.
Yeah.
Or you can try to do what he did and succeeded, which is to disperse the Knesset and go to elections again.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, it's such nonsense. Like,
it is nonsense.
Just
but
give the job to someone else. Anyone
who?
Else.
Who?
Anyone.
But who?
No, he wouldn't do it, but anyone else. Anyone else could have formed a coalition. It's just that Bibi has in my opinion, BB has a lot of problems, and that's why there are a lot of parties that want specific things from him or won't sit with him.
Yeah.
But they would sit with his party, just not with him specifically.
Oh, so you say give it to someone else from your party.
Yeah, yeah. But he would. I knew he wouldn't do it.
Of course.
You know? Yeah. Egomaniac.
I mean, people were saying, why didn't they give it to... Maybe we're going too deep now. But so there's the second biggest party, right? So people say, why don't you give it to the second biggest party? But that's his political rival, right?
Yeah, I really didn't expect him to give it to them. But I thought maybe he would just give it to someone else in his party until he deals with all of his investigations and legal stuff that's happening now and then. But yeah, whatever. It's stupid. It costs like 2 billion shekels or something like that every election.
I don't think so. I heard 140 million. That's what I heard.
Shekels? No, it's like 2 billion shekels because everyone's off
two
work.
2 billion shekels is our... I don't think it's that much.
No, because everyone's off work on that day.
Oh, so it's different between what's the...
No, yeah. It's not the cost for the country. It's just how much the country loses.
Yeah, yeah.
Overall.
The market.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I meant.
Yeah. Is that what we're producing today? 2 billion shekels? I don't think it sounds too much.
Just only on Tuesdays.
Only on Tuesdays. Yeah. Isn't Tuesdays like the worst day for work?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I don't know.
So all right. You want to introduce our guest?
Yes. And also, I wanted to say one more thing before we start.
Oh, the glue.
Yeah. This was crazy. I read it. So... It blew my mind. So instead
you should have your own like segment
of the podcast.
Yeah. At the end of each like intro, you should have your segment of like Tom tells about
medical innovations.
Yes, exactly.
No, but they invented Israeli scientists invented this glue that you can use instead of stitches. But the thing is, it's not, from what I understood, it works very, very fast. So it can actually be used during like a few seconds after the trauma happened to the patient, the person.
So you can close the wounds very fast.
Very fast, yeah. Instead of, you know, stop the bleeding and then do the stitching and all of that, you know, because we already have medical glue if like you got a cut on your chin or something like that. But I'm talking about like serious injuries, which I think is very, very cool.
All right.
Yeah.
Can we invest in it? Make any money of it?
Well, I think they're already selling it, so not so much anymore. But let's work on a different type of glue, you and I.
All right.
No.
Okay. I got you.
All right. Let's introduce our guest.
Yeah.
So we have here with us a very, very good friend of mine. Her name is Eden, and we've been friends for about 2 years already.
Yeah.
How are you, Eden?
Hi, good. Thanks for having me, guys.
Welcome.
You hear me well? You can hear me?
Yeah, we hear
good.
You perfectly. Yeah.
Good, welcome. Super excited. First of all, I love you guys. I listen to your episodes.
So you're the 14th person told me that
I think
already.
I was the 12th, and then
and
maybe...
And then like two more joined. Yeah. Like, Mom, please watch it. She's like, okay, fine.
Yeah, I'm going to be in the next episode. You should listen.
Nice.
Stuff like that. Yeah. First of all, I couldn't help myself by making facial expressions when you guys were talking about elections. Maybe we'll get a chance to talk about that too. But
it's
something that I can tell you as an Israeli that me, as others, many in Israel, are very, very annoyed with the situation of going to do this again. Although past elections were very, very optimistic for a lot of people, kind of feeling that there's a change in the air or something is going to move. And now we're back to point zero because...
Yeah,
you know, we kind of lost hope in our in democracy and our government as well. So.
Yeah,
I don't know why you think we lost hope. I mean, I think that
maybe hope.
I think this is democracy, right?
This is democracy. I think that maybe hope is not the right word. I think that we lost trust in our leaders. And when that's fun, right? Losing trust.
Oh wait, but 100%. It's classic. I mean, is there any leader, any country who believes in their leaders?
Trump.
When you have a leader that's for 10 years, and the next generation doesn't even see potential of having him, another regime with them.
Yeah.
We're not going to talk about Netanyahu right now. Maybe in the maybe later.
For sure.
Yeah.
You want to introduce yourself
yes,
a bit?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
So tell us.
Yes, my name is Eden, as you guys introduced me. I'm 29 years old, currently live in Tel Aviv. I'm married to my best friend, Noam. who's a data scientist. Originally, I'm from kibbutz. A kibbutz, if you guys don't... Have you guys talked about kibbutz before?
No, not.
I think it's a known maybe. Thing, though, isn't it?
People know about it, but I don't know. Okay, so explain a little bit about it.
Kibbutz is a kind of a shared environment of living, a shared community living, meaning, well, today it's not like that anymore, but when the country was established, the pioneers of Israel built communities that were shared economically and culturally, meaning they had no salaries, but everything they needed was available for them in reach, meaning dining rooms, housing, work was mainly agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of volunteers came around the world to volunteer in communities like that because the life experience was so outstanding and different than a lot of places in the world. So I'm actually a product of that combination of people around the world. My mom is Canadian. She came to the kibbutz when she was 19, met my dad.
Nice.
And here I am, half Syrian, half Canadian, sitting in front
Syrian?
Of you.
Syrian?
Yeah, Syrian. Where from? My dad is from Aleppo.
Oh, Halab. Yeah, Halab. Me too. My yeah. grandmother.
High five for Syrians
yeah,
from Aleppo.
Man. Yeah. Wait, your actual... people could hear that high five.
You want to nice. Do it again?
It happened.
Yeah, yeah. So Aleppo high five.
Hold on, your dad is from Aleppo.
His parents are. Yeah, right. He has one brother who was born in Aleppo and then they immigrated to okay. Israel. If I'll have time, I'll tell you about my first and only meeting with Syrian refugees in Berlin. That when they realized that I'm an Israeli from a Syrian background, their mind was like,
yeah,
you know, they're like, what?
Wow.
Yeah, that was a beautiful.
Wait, hold on.
What's the last name?
My last name?
The Syrian last name?
Aini.
Aini?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to talk
about Laniado.
That. Laniado?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to talk about that too. I think we have a few more episodes.
Okay.
what do I do?
So what do you do? Why did we bring you here?
I come from the field of public diplomacy.
Okay.
Which is such a general big word that people are like throwing around without really knowing what it means.
Yes.
But technically, it's about... persuading or showing a narrative that isn't really shown today in public opinion, either on social media or in person. And specifically what I do, I talk about Israel through public diplomacy. I allow people have the opportunity to listen to me or other people like me who are not government officials, people talking about our countries. Sometimes we talk about complex realities. Sometimes we talk about universal values that Israelis and Israel are, you know, believe in. And sometimes we talk about the beautiful face of Israel. But technically, it's allowing people to have tools, the public itself, to learn about another public or to talk about the place we're from. Mm-hmm. That just expose more people. And I think that as we talk, you guys will have a bit more understanding yeah. of it.
Okay. But you do it in a quite a special way, don't
right.
you?
Yeah. Right. Maybe I'll talk a little bit about how I started doing what I'm doing and then
right.
talk a little bit about where I work and what we do.
Yeah. Okay.
So how did you get started in this specific field?
So I think maybe because my mom, being a Canadian, and she was an English teacher for a while and she went to a lot of conventions around the world, our house was filled with a lot of people from all over the world. And I remember myself being a 10-year-old sitting with, you know, a bunch of people from different places in the world and was fascinated by two things. The first thing was fascinating for me is their countries and their culture and the things that, you know, their beliefs and faith and the things they came with. But the other thing was very fascinating for me was to tell where I'm from, because I understood really fast that we're different like anyone else is different. And the ability or the opportunity to talk about where I'm from and what we're doing and who am I and my identity as an Israeli
mm-hmm.
was something quite addictive in a way. So the internationalism field of my life was something that I loved since day one, I think. After the army, as you guys probably know and talked about, Israeli has a mandatory army service.
What did you do?
I was in the paratroopers unit.
Okay.
I didn't jump from a plane, if okay. that was the next answer
to your
question.
I was just about to ask.
I was the head coordinator of the battalion of the paratroopers. I served for 2 years. And when I got released, I traveled around the world like all Israelis do. I met my husband there. And
where did you travel?
I went to Central America. I traveled all the way from Mexico down to Peru for almost 7 months.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing. There's not a day in my life I'm not like wishing to go back and like stop what I'm doing now and just go back traveling. I went studying informal education and communication. One word about informal education. I think in the world there's like this belief about educators are only teachers. And mm-hmm. today we know that educators can do so many other things but teaching in classrooms.
100%.
And when we learn about education in a form that is not formal, in a classroom, sitting behind, you know, a desk and looking at a blackboard, a lot of opportunity opens up. And that's what I kind of majored in, and how to educate people in an informal environment, and communication studies. And I think along the way, I learned that Israel is a topic that should be more educated upon.
Mm-hmm.
I must say that I don't want it to sound like very, like, you know, kind of a snobby kind of, oh, we will educate you guys because you don't know. But it's more
about... But we will educate you guys because you don't know.
It's more about... I know that I have a lot of ignorance about things, and I come up with, you know, assumptions about things I don't know just because I don't know.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's the case where we are. You know, where our position right now is, people have opinion about Israel about from really, really tiny bits of information they have, and they have this whole assumption or opinion or, you know, thoughts around something they don't know. And it's our jobs as citizens who care about this place to do that education process and just give more facts to people in a fun, intelligent way that makes people want to listen to you and not fight with you.
No, that's really true. I mean, I remember speaking to some people once. I don't remember how long ago was that, and they were shocked when I told them that not all Israelis have a European background. That's not like, as you mentioned, that you're half Syrian.
Oh, I have a great story about that.
Yeah,
I had a friend. Listen, this is crazy. I had a friend who was very, very anti-Israeli. I'm going to talk about anti-Israelism in a second, but. I don't know if you guys know about BDS and how they work and stuff like that. BDS stands for BDS. First of all, is a boycott movement against Israel.
Boycott, divestment, and sanctions.
Exactly, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. When we talk about boycotting, meaning culturally, economically, academic, and so on. Sanctions, the same, and divestment meaning stop investments in Israel and so on. The way it works in universities across the state, across the world, not only the states, by the way, currently we have around 460 universities and colleges who are supporting BDS, meaning they are boycotting any other academics.
The college supports BDS?
Yeah, yeah. And the way it works, if we're talking about that, is that BDS organizations inside campuses can offer the student body, the student union, to support BDS. And the way they do that the student union opens 24 hours where they allow all students for a full day to come and convince them should they or shouldn't they support BDS and then boycott Israel. During that 24 hours, people from all backgrounds come and talk in front of them, and then they make a decision. If they make the decision to boycott and to support BDS, no delegations to Israel, no articles, no artists, no anything.
So
right,
academic
anything.
Boycott.
Yeah, no
cultural, economic, and academic.
No, but the college has the power to academically boycott.
Yes. The student union has the ability to boycott academically Israel as well. Meaning the minute the student union support, the whole university faculty also needs to stand by it.
Okay.
I guess, you know, people are listening and saying, hey, that's not like that in my university or my college, but in general, that's how
it can be from
work.
Like big things like no academic cooperation with Tel Aviv University.
Yeah.
And it can be with little things like no hummus at the cafeteria of Harvard.
Israeli brand.
Israeli hummus.
Anyway, the story stands. So a lot of pro-Israeli organization, what they're doing, they're trying to give the opportunity for the student union body participants to be exposed to Israel and make their own mind and not rely on people convincing them or not convincing them. And when they do so, they encourage people to come visit Israel. Sometimes they pay for a ticket and stuff like that. And a friend of mine who I met in one of my tours and delegation that I've been to, it was very, very anti-Israeli. And he said, you know what? I'm going to go to that tour to Israel and I'm going to prove everything I thought was right and come back and, you know, like really, really, you know, kind of going to support BDS full in. So he hopped on the opportunity of having a free ticket to Israel and he got to the airport and a taxi driver.
Where is he from, this guy?
This guy was from the state. His background was from Colombia, specifically.
Okay.
And he was the head of the student union.
Wait, Colombia, the university?
No, Colombia, the country.
Colombia, the country, okay.
And he landed in Israel for the first time, super, like, you know, having really, really bad thought and negative, you know, agenda around Israel, waiting for a taxi. Taxi pulls by and he sits next to the driver, which was a guy, I hope people won't think I'm racist, but he was a bit Middle East ethnicity kind of a look to him.
Yeah.
And
I think I know where this is going, and I like it.
And
okay.
The guy, my friend was looking at the driver, and he's like, so are the Jews occupying you and occupiers, and do they like
so
kind
thought,
of restrain
your
rights?
So he thought this
rights?
Guy is...
He thought this guy is an Arab,
yeah.
Or a Palestinian in that matter, yeah. And asked him a lot of questions like, how do you feel? How are your rights? What are they doing to you? And this guy like looks at him after 5 minutes like, dude, I'm Yemeni. What do you want from me? And at that moment, like he said, I could literally feel, you know, the light bulb turning on like cling. Yeah. It's like, wait, hold your horses. Do you have people from Middle East in Israel that are not, you know, Muslims? He's like, not all Jews came from Europe? Like, that conception of the ethno-supremacist white people who came from Europe,
yeah,
to conquer the land of Palestine...
Colonialism, man.
...is so far-fetched in what's happening here. And for the first time that he realized that there are people from Muslim countries who are Jewish, who live here, it was mind-blowing for him. And not only that, after his trip in Israel, from being a super anti-Israel, he became... super pro-Israeli. He came back telling people this amazing story of, you know, how he met.
Wow.
He just got married, mazal tov,
a week ago.
He's not Jewish, but he got married with a rabbi, and he had like a an atalit.
What?
And yeah, he's really, really into it.
That's also strange. It's like the other extreme, right?
He went like really far to the other extreme, but I think that was a taste of what we talked about before, about the ignorance of just saying like, those ethno-supremacist people who are like
It's also this reaction that, you know, you grow, like, you live for a while with this certain belief, and all of a sudden it pops, and then you're like, oh, so everything I knew is a lie, and then you go to the other extreme, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It happens sometimes. I've seen it also with some people that I know.
I think that it's not everything is a lie. I think even for us, we don't know about, you know, wars going in Africa enough to have an opinion. We don't really know what's going on.
And you can't expect us to know,
right? We can't expect us, but at the same time...
Like, you can't expect people from... Even, like, the United States know anything about... I mean, why should they care, honestly?
Right.
When someone cares about, let's say, Israel and is not from here, I'm surprised. Like,
Me too.
You shouldn't care. Why? I mean, why?
But in what I do, which I'm going to talk soon, it's kind of, I feel like I'm like kind of making you guys like expect this. I'm not building anything big, but I'm going to talk about it in a minute. You'd be surprised about the amount of articles Israel has in the international news. Like, BBC and CNN are obsessed. And when I'm saying obsessed, it's like literally I have a screen, three screens open in my office, BBC, CNN, Sky News. And when the elections were happening, it was like 16 hours straight.
But
just
it's
showing,
different, isn't it? Because that's like, it's like, I don't know, watching like the Big Brother or something on television. Mm. It's like action. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah, but
it's
why
drama.
Israel? Like, at the same time, month before that, there were elections in Brazil. And it was like...
Yes, but that's what I'm saying.
Maybe
Israel,
one...
Israel
also
is
Brazil,
drama.
Brazil
Israel
has a lot
drama.
Of influence in the world. Like, Brazil is a huge country. It's a really growing economy.
Yes, but you
know?
Think...
I think it was Brazil.
Yes, but television channels care about drama. They
don't care about
actual...
Exactly.
Sure.
And I think the point of what I was saying is, like, I think with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it's a very, let's call it, like, a sexy conflict, right? Because
there is a weak
and strong. It's like David and Goliath.
Yeah.
It's like the underdog on the strong.
The indigenous versus the colonialist.
Yeah, and
like, you know.
Listen, I could totally get it.
Yeah.
It's not surprising that so many other, communities who are feeling as part of the underdog in their societies would support Palestinians.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
why you see Mexicans
yeah.
for Palestine,
for sure.
Latins
South
for Palestine,
Africa.
South Africa. Like, so I think that's very, very natural for people to relate to the underdog who is fighting for a cause that the cause for a lot of people would see something as liberalism and something that would be freedom of speech, freedom of movement. Those mm-hmm. things that all three of us agree on, and I think all Israelis would agree on as something important.
Universal values.
But at the same time, if you don't understand the core of the conflict itself or the history of it, it's really, really black and white for you. And then you choose one side instead of understanding, wait, it's much more complex than that. It's much more, you know, long and heavy concept. And that Israel has much to offer than just a conflict.
Oh, yeah.
Like, 100%. Way more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you do to show people that Israel has
worked
well?
So I work in a small NGO, non-government organization, which is really important actually to mention, which I'm going to explain why, that we do crowdsourcing for Israel online, not for fundraising, but actually for online activism. We know today that 90% of opinions about Israel or about any topic is formed from social media. Okay, people are reading their news in social media, and if it's a topic they don't know about,
especially young people,
and it's a topic, if there's a topic they don't know about, usually they would go into reading comments or tweets or following people who they think they know more.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, when we talk about, you know, the battle between opinions, between, you know, pro-Israeli, anti-Israeli, whatever, by the way, listen carefully that I'm not using the word pro-Palestinians, because I'm pretty sure that even people who are pro-Israelis would see themselves as pro-Palestinians. It's nothing about against Palestinians when we're talking about Israel. I'm specifically focusing on Israel
so
itself.
It's not, that's a good point. Yeah, so probably. So pro-Israeli doesn't mean anti-Palestinian.
Absolutely.
And pro-Palestinian doesn't mean anti-Israeli.
True. Okay. Yeah. And a lot of people are mixing it because they're saying, oh, don't get me wrong, I'm not, you know, anti-Israeli and this and this and this, but when they talk and they say, oh, Israel doesn't have the right to exist or things like that,
yeah,
that's being anti-Israeli, that's not being pro-Palestinians.
Yeah.
And we can have a talk, only the three of us, of saying how, you know, we think Israel should be the Jewish state on the land of Israel, at the same time hoping for a Palestinian state, that's being pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian at the same time. It doesn't,
yeah,
has to come upon another. And today I'm going to focus specifically about pro-Israeli and anti-Israeli. And when we talk about those people who are, you know, kind of attaching an identity of pro-Israeli or anti-Israeli, we talk about a percentage of, out of all the people who are exposed to content about Israel, 5% are what we call blue audience who are pro-Israeli. In the pro-Israeli, we would find Jewish communities, we would find Israelis, we would find Christians who support Israel, and so on. On the other side of the spectrum, we have 5% of red audience, which we would call anti-Israeli. We would find their terror organizations. We would find a lot of anti-Semitic issues, the people who, you know, do or act in anti-Semitic ways, and so on. And in the middle, we have 90% of what we call gray audience. They mm-hmm. just don't know. They don't know. They don't care. It's not interesting. They're undecided about their opinion, and it's absolutely fine because that's how the word should be. And I think the battle between the 5% of blue audience and 5% of red audience is not about, you know, shifting everyone to be pro or anti-Israel. It's about the consciousness. In Hebrew, the word is todah. It's about the image they have in mind when they think about Israel. Is it positive or is it a negative one? And getting back to social media, when people have an image in their mind about Israel today, it's all shaped of what they read and what they see. And in that discussion about Israel, unfortunately, Israelis and the pro-Israeli audience is lacking. It's not there. There is literally a battle and a war going on. And it's not even that we're losing. We're not present there at all.
So you're saying those 5% of blue audience don't exist in the...
It's the same amount of... It's not that they don't exist. They're less active. And then we need to ask ourselves why. It's 5% and 5%, okay?
Yeah, it's like people
number.
That, you know, like, you have your own opinions, and you go, you read this comment, and you got, like, I don't know, 150 likes, whatever, 300 likes. But you're like, yeah, but this guy's crazy, you know, who cares, like that. But the thing is that they don't realize that people that don't know go to these, to the comment section, and then they see, oh, this guy got a lot of likes, he must know what he's talking about. A lot of people agree with him.
So you're saying the 5% that are anti-Israeli has more impact on the 90%?
Absolutely. I think that the question we need to ask ourselves is why the 5% of blue audience, pro-Israeli audience, are less active. And there's a lot of reasons. Every time I give a lecture, I talk about, you know, how to be active for Israel. People say, oh, there's no way that the red audience are 5%. They feel way more. Yeah. And again, it's not that they feel more. The blue audience are just less active. Why? It's really simple. First of all, it's way more easier to support the underdog, right? It's way more easier to be on the side that is weaker because it's a liberal value that you support. Now, for Israelis, we're all three Israelis, and, you know, in Israel, we don't feel the problems of, I don't know, BDS, or we don't feel anti-Semitic issues and stuff like that. Then we are not in the discussion to start with. pro-Israelis that are outside of Israel have a lot to lose if they're active about it. They could lose friends. They could lose, they have, I don't know, if they're students, then they could lose, you know, opportunities for job later if people see their post. It's not a value that a lot of people, unless you have really, really thick skin, enough background, enough knowledge to stand tall and say, I understand that you think that supporting terrorism, listen, I'm not saying Palestinians, I'm saying terrorism as Hamas and terror that is happening in Gaza and the West Bank is a liberal cause, but you're wrong and here are the facts, or here is my opinion, or here's whatever they're kind of portraying. What we're doing as an organization, I work in a place called ACT-IL, what we're doing is that we're searching the web daily for points where the pro-Israeli can act together as a community. The same way, unfortunately, that boycott movements work, right? They put up a main value and a lot of people can connect it really easily. Or they're telling everyone, now support the boycott against, or, I don't know, pressure Lana Del Rey not to come to Israel for a performance.
Yeah.
And that's happening. We search the web for things that the pro-Israeli can work together. Meaning, be present in a discussion about Israel on a comment. Okay, we know today that people, like I said before, are shaping their opinion through comments. If it's a topic they don't know, it's called active reading. If you don't know something and you read the header, maybe the first paragraph, the first thing you do after that is scrolling down to see what other people think. And when it's a topic about Israel and people say, oh, they're baby killers and they're rapers and they're rapists and they're doing a lot of awful things, if all the comments are like that, I wouldn't be surprised that people think the same. You know, like that's only that. So what we do is we compose an intelligent, relevant, coherentic comment, and we encourage our community to interact with it. Why? You can do like, you can do share, you can do repost, whatever. But we know today that the algorithm of social media works like this, that the most interaction that a comment has with people, it goes up. Therefore, we want to be one of the top three. Again, it's not about convincing people. It's allowing people to have another side to read, or another, you know, opportunity to learn something that is different in the discussion, because we know that it's not black or white. There are many, many shades of gray in the middle that could be part of it. We use our community in order to take off inciting content. You'd be surprised the amount of materials on the web that teaches people how to stab Israelis in the neck, how to kidnap soldiers.
Is it any different from stabbing any other person in the neck?
I don't know, because I think Jews have like green blood and a tail, so I think you need to grab them by the tail and then hold them with their horns.
Yeah.
So I think it's a bit different.
You draw a Star of David on the floor and then
attract them to the middle.
You spin them around, exactly, and you spin them around six times.
Yeah, and I heard that... Never. Yeah, no. I'll stop there. I had a few
let's stop, because we can go on for a long time.
Yeah.
Throw some coins on the floor. No, I'm kidding. Okay.
So
to lure them in.
Yeah.
We know today, if I'm kind of summarizing what we do in ACT-IL, and then we can talk about, you know, examples of really interesting things we notice on the web. Online activism is something that people have in mind when they think of activism, is like, you know, going out to the streets and holding signs in front of the government or municipality or something physical you're at. But today, there is a lot of power to act together online as well. And for a lot of people, it's scary. That's why we see the less, you know, activity of the pro-Israeli side, that they're, you know, like, I don't know enough. I don't want to, you know, come out as stupid. It's really hard to fight with emotions. We would do the heavy lifting. We are searching the web. We have an app that's called ACT-IL. Surprising.
Yeah.
The app actually shows you all the places and small things that can take 30 seconds of your day, small things that you can do in order to help the Israeli narrative be out there. We never support parties. We never support political issues. We will never go against individuals. The whole idea is being present in the discussion, just opening another opportunity for people to listen and have, you know, a public diplomacy experience.
Yeah. That's actually really good, because sometimes, you know, you can find this, I don't know, let's say an article about Israel, Palestine, whatever, and then there's a comment that's very, very hateful. And you can see that the person is basing their information on not facts, mm-hmm. basically. But then if one of the replies to the comment is more balanced, for example, then and also gets a lot of likes, what you see when you, even if you don't, or if you're not going specifically into that comment replies, you just go on the comment section, it will also pop up. Let's say there's a comment with, like, I don't know, 1,500 likes, you know,
right.
And there's a reply with 500 likes, 800 likes, they will both show. And then the person reading the comment will automatically see that reply because it has the most likes, even if it's reply number 20 or reply number 200.
Right.
You know?
Right, absolutely. And I also think that, listen, I wrote quite a lot of comments about a lot of articles. I think the one of the things that most kind of encouraging me to keep on going, it's not about the amount of likes. It's true because it helps the cause, but it's more about the discussion that opens up after I comment about something.
Yeah.
And I never comment, you know, first of all, I think another power to it, to being very, very authentic and real, is because we're real people. No, the government doesn't pay us to do it. The army is not, you know, giving us budget to do it. It's an NGO. It's real people who care. And when I say, hey guys, this is quite wrong, I'm an Israeli here, let me give you my perspective, we can talk about it.
Actually, I wanted to ask you, maybe you know, I just thought about it. Like, where does this thing of, oh, you're getting paid by the government comes from?
I think that when Israel has a really, really negative image to it, okay? Yeah. And it's so negative that you wouldn't believe that real people would support something like that. When you see people who support that, they're either evil or paid by the evil government.
Okay. you know what I mean? It's weird. I had like some friends of mine that they told me, like, listen, we're getting comments like, oh, you Hasbara troll, like you pro-Israel troll, you're getting paid by Bibi. And it's like, man, like, I'm definitely not getting paid by Bibi.
So. I thought you she did, didn't you?
Yeah, a little bit.
Another thing is, I think that you won't find a lot of people around the world talking about their country like we do. They don't have a reason to, right? They don't have a reason to advocate for their country.
But also Israelis are like...
Second,
ridiculously passionate about their country.
I think that nationalism became in the last half of a century something very, very negative. And it's
in the Western
funny,
world.
In the Western world. Yeah. And if we talk about what happened in the history of nationalism in general, is that we see that after, like, before World War II, it was like the peak of nationalism where, you know, we saw like the German Empire and whatever's going on there as something that it got to the peak of it. And then after World War II, there was a huge drop. We could see it in multiculturalism, like Berlin became this beautiful open space for a lot of cultures to migrate and to mix in with each other.
Mm-hmm.
But with the same drop of nationalism, Israel rised, right? Israel kind of formed after World War II with a huge amount of nationalism because that's the way to survive. And it's a value that for a lot of people, like I met a lot of German friends of mine who said, I feel uncomfortable when I see the German flag.
Yeah.
It makes me feel uncomfortable. I don't know why, but
that.
Or I never sing the German anthem. And I can understand when you have a history of nationalism being something very, very scary. But for Israel, it's the only way to survive. Because if you have immigrants coming all over the world to be in the same land, to be citizens of the same country, with the same values.
From many different cultures.
You need to have what we call a melting pot. Right? We need
same
to
as
have
the United
something.
States, right?
United
I don't think
States.
there are any Americans that are ashamed of their anthem. Or
true.
I mean, Americans are very patriotic, very, very patriotic.
Yeah, they are.
I mean, you can't.
They can be very criticism though by on their government, but they're very American. That's true.
Yes, but they'll never, almost never, criticize the army, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people would, but most.
Remember
of them,
Vietnam?
Yeah,
I think it's a bit different.
Well, yes, but even then, I don't think it's like I don't think it was the majority of the people. It was a bunch of hippies, right?
Right.
Like.
Yeah. Yeah,
not really.
So maybe what we're maybe getting to a point here, which is actually quite interesting.
But do you
saying...
think? Do you think that in Israel, it's like nationalism? I mean, yeah, obviously we have nationalists and we have like extreme.
Oh yeah, yeah. There is extreme. There is liberal.
I think that most Israelis are very proud of their country.
Absolutely, I think that in order to create people, okay, with peoplehood.
Mm-hmm.
A mute, okay, peoplehood
yeah.
that acts together. You need to have the big bricks, you know, the big values that sits and connects us.
Okay.
And it starts with the language, okay,
mm-hmm.
the Hebrew language, that everyone here are talking the same language, reading the same language. In a lot of countries, it's like that as well. But I'm going to give examples of where it's not and where it's a difference. And it's kind of this melting pot of taking a lot of people from different places and making them as one. And in order to make us one, you need to have something that connects people. So here it's really easy because it's a Jewish state. So the holidays apply to I don't know, 80% of the citizens here have the same holidays, the same tradition, the same kind of mentality. One way to be connected. Right. We all served the army. Our parents did, our brothers did, our siblings did, we did, probably, unfortunately, our kids will.
Yeah.
It's another connection, okay? We are under a threat, so-called. It's another connection, okay?
It's the biggest connection.
A lot of things. Yeah, actually, there's a really interesting article that I read talking about how anti-Semitism is one of the reasons Jews are very united, okay? If you don't have a threat, then you're not...
Yeah. It's true. It's actually in the states where there's the least anti-Semitism, there's the most... marriages between Jews and non-Jews,
right?
Like in Germany in the 1920s, for example, where Jews were really almost completely assimilating. Also before World War One in Austria-Hungary. How do you say that in English? Austria-Hungary, I think it's called in English. Anyway, in America today, there's around 80% of Jews in America marry non-Jews, which obviously, like, there's nothing specifically wrong with that. It's just that according to the laws of the religion, you're not allowed to marry someone who's not Jewish.
Yeah, but so, that's another podcast episode that you're going to invite me to talk about, streams in Judaism, Reform, Orthodox, and so on.
Yeah.
But if we're getting for a minute about nationalism and why what happened with Israel, which is very different, we need to compare between multiculturalism, which, let's take Berlin, for example, and melting pot as Israel. Multiculturalism is where a lot of cultures live one beside another in one place. Okay, in Berlin, we could see the Turkish community, the Indian community, the German community, and so on.
Yeah, like in London also.
Like in London, like in Canada, and a lot of other places.
Yeah.
Which is beautiful to see a lot of different cultures living in the same place. But one of the problems with multiculturalism is that what is the glue? Are we just living in the same city? Do we care about the place we live in? I met a lot of Turkish German who refer themselves as Turkish, and they are already, I don't know, three generation in Berlin.
Yeah, it's also a big problem in France.
In France, a lot of communities who don't even speak the common language because they don't need. They're living in their own community that they can talk, you know, in their own native language. They have their own private schools. And then you ask yourself, okay, so we're just citizens who are sharing the same land, but we don't care about the country or the state itself.
Yeah. But do you think glue is it's necessary?
Let's say Canada.
People need glue to
yes,
I think
and I'm going to explain in a minute why I think. I think Canada is a good example for a country who took multiculturalism to another level and made it infrastructure as the way of the country acts and thinks. And I think the best example they did so is that it was a good commercial for something that Canada did, that they had like a fridge with soft drink, a lot of like soda and Cokes and orange juice and whatever.
Yeah.
And in order to open it, people had to come and say, "I'm Canadian" in different languages. So someone came and said, "I'm Canadian" in Japanese. And then someone came and said, "I'm Canadian" in Spanish. And then other, you know what I mean? Like they took the native people, immigrants who lived there, because Canada, like Israel, is an immigrant kind of a country. And after like 10 languages being said, "I'm Canadian," the fridge opened up and everyone had the drinks.
Sounds like a hassle.
Yeah, like you know, grabbing people from the street and saying like that. But the idea was,
look,
saying,
do you know Japanese? I need to open my fridge.
I need a Japanese guy. Come on.
I'm hungry.
We're just missing one more Spanish guy.
Yeah.
Anyone know Turkish?
Yeah.
But I think you got the idea of how they managed to establish saying it's okay you being from a different place, but we're all Canadians. Melting pot also has problems with it. We know it. We live in the third generation of people who felt as though their identity was erased. Like people who came from, I don't know, different countries were had to stand in, you know, stand in line, acting the same, looking the same like other any Israelis. Our grandparents felt as though they were not only discriminated, but were forced to learn and speak in a language that isn't their own. They had to like act according to the standards of what was then the European Ashkenazi Jewish kind of community.
Yeah.
But the glue is necessary for something that is very, very relevant that we can talk about. I think we had a talk about it, Tom, you and I, a few days ago.
Yeah. Probably.
And I asked myself, how come in Israel they're isn't the same amount of massacre shooting than in other places in the world? Now, we have terrorism. That's not bitter. Sababa. But And then I got to the point of saying, okay, is it maybe about second? Sorry for jumping, but second is also we're just less people. So like that's another option. Okay. That maybe it's not happening. But I thought about the feeling of belonging to something, and the more that we have common and share problems. Remember, we talked about threats as yeah. being united.
Yeah.
It's something that gives a different environment of individuals to act differently.
So you think the glue between people allows us to be to have more empathy for one another? Or
no, wait. I don't think empathy.
Yeah, empathy.
Let's take the other way around, okay? I think that Israelis, no matter where they're at or what they believe in and stuff like that, they have a sense of belonging to something bigger than them. They're part yeah. of the Jewish community. They're part of the land of Israel. They always have something in common with other people here, and their problems might feel as though they are shared with other people. And adding to that, Israel has a lot of national problems, okay? So for generation, people who felt depressed, anxiety, a lot of personal fears, our parents' generation got educated or raised in the feeling of like, there are bigger problems than your issues, right? Yeah. There's a war going on. How can you be depressed now? Or there are yeah. bigger issues. Like, it's not about you. It's about
us. Yeah. Yeah.
And if we take the States or other places where a lot of people feel as though they might have a lot of money or they might be a part of this really wealthy society, but they're lonely in the sense of belonging to something bigger than them. That's where we see a lot of anxiety happening, and we see a lot of depression, and we see a lot of people spiraling down where they feel like not connected. By the way, that's why a lot yeah. of young Americans are coming here
yeah, yeah.
to feel that.
There was actually there was a study that was that. I didn't read all of it. I just read like the title and the abstract. So I'll get back to you on that. But that actually found that Scandinavian teenagers are some of the most depressed in the world. Even though technically the Scandinavian countries are like the happiest countries. And from what they said, at least, it's about that there is like, yes, there is a sense of, you know, we're all Danish, we're all Swedish, whatever. But it's not really like that. Like no one will say if there's a, let's say there's a Moroccan immigrant in Norway and they don't speak Norwegian, I feel like they won't be as criticized as a Moroccan immigrant to, let's say, Israel or America that doesn't speak English.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, I get
it. So you're saying the glue is crucial to a sense of community.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, 100%.
The question is, what is the glue?
Yeah.
That's a bit... Maybe it's the glue that sticks the stitches.
Yeah, I feel like, yeah, exactly. I was about to say that.
We talked about it. In Israel, the glue is the threat and our Jewish
exactly. but not just
no, the threat and our Jewish heritage.
Yes, and also like what I love about when I look at Israeli culture, I give you a lot of times as an example, and I'm pointing at Daniel at the moment because Daniel's father is from, like, his family is originally from Romania, and yeah. your mom's family is originally from Syria.
High five,
yeah.
Syria.
Yeah. Woo. That's like the third high five we had, and we did this, like, really? The seventh podcast.
Please don't be jealous.
Okay, sorry, my bad. I'm just, you know, full on German Lithuanian, so I feel bad. But first of all, I really like this, you know, these like mix and match kind of things in the Israeli community, and also that in so many families in Israel, gefilte fish, which is some disgusting Polish fish patty,
not
couscous can be together on the same table at dinner, you know.
Yeah.
So I feel like let's say the glue, and you were right, like when you asked what is the glue, I think that yes, certain things from immigrants have to be they have to give them up when they come to a new place, but there are certain things that they can add also, and it's really important to know where to point the line.
Right, not everywhere. You are right, absolutely. And I think, first of all, I must say to whoever is listening to us, this is my personal assumption about the topic. Like, I really yeah. want to look into it and read.
Oh, you're not God? I thought, okay, sorry, my bad.
It's better than a God. I can yeah, be...
Exactly. Everything said here has a disclaimer on it.
Yeah.
Bunch of idiots talking. Do not...
Do not take seriously. Yes, the trigger warning. Actually,
this is a serious.
I think we're pretty smart, I have to say.
I think one of the assumptions that I got after that kind of thinking and talking to some friends about that topic about if we have more problems in our country, are we more happy? Because if we take happy as individuals, because if we take the other way around, like Scandinavians, you know, countries who has very wealthy countries, economic is not an issue. They don't have war with anyone. Poverty is not an issue. Immigrants is maybe the newest challenge that they're facing. And even that, they're doing it nicely and politely.
Yeah.
Then people's, what are their problems?
Yeah.
Depression?
Yeah, I'll tell you what it is. We talked about it before, I think, with Tanya in one of our former episodes, the sense of purpose and hunger.
Yeah.
And so Israel is, because nothing is perfect here.
Yeah.
We have this hunger and this sense of trying to achieve something, which is, I think, contributes a lot to one's happiness.
Absolutely.
Like having a sense of...
drive.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And hunger. And countries that have... that their lives are pretty
balanced,
and just like well-rounded, right? They have everything.
Yes,
so they lack this sense of like achievement and
it's true. But I also think it depends on what the challenge is. So for example, let's say Israeli education. Most Israelis would agree that our education system is not so good. And I think most Israelis...
you're talking here to a former teacher, but
Yeah, but overall, our education system is like could be much better than it is now. But that's the thing. Most Israelis are saying it could be much better. So it pushes a lot of Israelis to, if not actively work, at least agree in thought that we should do something about the education system. Whereas, let's say, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, not a lot of people know how to actually solve it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Because a lot of people are saying like, well... yeah, we could just not give them a state and annex everything, but then we're just going to rule over millions of Palestinians and we don't want that. Well, we could just withdraw, but then every time we withdraw, we get more bombs. So what's the point? And so I think it's important to have not necessarily problems, but let's say challenges.
Yeah, and I think this is something that is very beautiful to look on the Israeli society. As Israelis, we tend to always criticize our, you know, our country and the government, whatever we're doing.
And also, we're generally beautiful people. And
but when we're talking about something that is very, very special about the Israeli society and generation-wise, is that in literally generalization, Israelis haven't seen things as a problem but as a challenge. And what you said now is core element, because if we take things like 70 years back... you know, pioneers and people who came to settle the desert and put, you know, communities there. It was a freaking desert. Literally desert, okay?
Desert and swamps.
And they managed to make that desert into agriculture heaven, okay? We're talking about greenhouse who are growing peppers to all across all over Europe.
Yeah.
We're talking about water synchronizing and kind of making
desalination.
Yeah. Thank you. I hate that word.
desalination
kind of a word.
Yeah.
That's something that I'm pretty sure there are people all over the world who take problems as challenges, but when it is a policy of a state to do so, it's something that is very, very
also it's something everybody do together, right?
Right. And it's about people having achieved, like feeling of achievement and man is willing to do something. But how are we in times?
Because we
have a lot to cover.
I mean, we're basically out of time.
I really wonder what would be the headline of this.
episode. I think it was pretty, things connected.
I suggest the name good. The Glue.
The Glue. Nice.
That's a good one.
I want credit.
I mean, everything was really glue themed today, right?
Yeah.
I think it was a good day to bring
and
up.
And not on purpose. That's the thing.
Not on purpose.
It's amazing. And now everyone's singing like, it was on purpose. 100% was on purpose.
Before we finish, do you want to say, I think you barely talked about the app. So I think the app is very interesting. And
yeah,
also
please.
To people, if someone want to take part or something.
Download it, check it out.
So it's like a checklist or
so
how
the
exactly
app is,
does it work?
Is really cool. It's really friendly to use. Act.il. You can find it in your App Store or your Google Play. Like I said before, what we do is we search the web daily, 24 hours. We look for things that the community can work upon together. In
and
the
you give
app,
them tasks.
Yeah, exactly. It's like small missions that you can choose and filterize. If you're usually on YouTube, if you're on Twitter, if you're on Facebook, if you're on Instagram, and then things pop up. It's either report this to Instagram, meaning this is anti-Semitic, violent, or hate speech. It should be down. Maybe sometimes it would ask you to interact with a comment or a like an article. Sometimes we ask to share. But the idea is that your 30 seconds adds up to 19,000 others who are downloading the app or download the app and a part of our community who are active. So we have a lot of people in a small act of our act,
that's
you
power.
Know, that's power. And people understand today that one like feels as nothing. But when it's 300 likes, it's something that could really change and be part of the narrative. It's super easy. It's very, very intuitive, meaning it will take you directly. I must add that the app is not doing any use of your profile, private information. We're not using your likes. We're not using your email address for anything.
They didn't cross the creepy line of Google.
Right.
You know.
And I think what's beautiful about it, it's real people doing real things. It's not bots. It's not trolls. It's not anything. It's the opportunity for people who want to act just to do it in their terms and the way they feel comfortable and in any channel they need. And for people who have special skills like graphic designers or people who translate or people who speak other language, we have professional community as well. For example, in times of crisis, we come up to our graphic designer community and say, hey guys, we need your help with infographics about this and this and this. And the community really comes together in order to do something for the rest.
What about
kind
dentists?
Of a glue, right?
The glue.
So we have a community of dentists that, that give free treatment to Israelis. No, not really.
There you go.
All right. Eden, thank you so much for being here.
Have me again.
It was an absolute
really
pleasure.
Fun.
We'll definitely have you again.
100%. It was insane. Insane episode.
It was good.
Insane.
It was good.
Seriously.
Glued.
Yala, Danny.
Just got glued. thank you, people. And you just got glued.
You got glued. All right. Yeah, guys. Thank you for being here. And yala, Shabbat Shalom.
See you next time.
Bye-bye.